Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Tallahassee Regional Airport, offering service through American Airlines with daily direct flights from Tallahassee to Miami and Dallas-Fort Worth, with connections to over 270 domestic and international destinations. Fares and information available online at aa.com. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
People who knew former Florida Governor Ruben Askew remember him in Tallahassee this week.
But we're here just to show our respects for someone who I think made a difference for Florida.
Also tonight, Florida's public schools may be in line for more money this year, but the question is, where will the money come from?
What they're saying is that if you take the same rate and charge it against a higher value, then you're going to bring in more money.
We'll also hear the latest on a plan to force baby boomers to be tested for hepatitis C, the fate of a bill to regulate parasailing companies, and we might even get in a little fishing. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. There's an old saying in Tallahassee that few things short of the death of a governor can halt the legislature once it's in session, but this very situation has come to pass with the passing of Ruben Askew on Thursday of last week. Yesterday, lawmakers suspended their midday meetings while the body of the former governor lay in the historic old Capitol. Today, there was a church service in Tallahassee, with a second one set to take place later in Pensacola, where Askew will be laid to rest. Jessica Palumbo has the story and the memories of those who knew this much-loved Florida governor.
A military honor guard escorted Askew's flag-draped coffin up the historic Capitol steps Tuesday as leaders from the three branches of government looked on. Askew served in the Army and Air Force before being elected to the Florida House in 1958. In accordance with military tradition, Army Colonel Glenn Sutphin said Askew's family laid a white rose atop his coffin once it got to the building's second floor.
At the end of the day, when we take him back up again, before the honor guard's released, the rose will be returned to the family to show that we have guarded the leader and all is well.
Before the public was allowed inside, Patsy McNeely waited at the bottom of the steps.
I worked as his scheduler for the last 3 years that we were in office. I just consider it a real honor. That's why we're here.
Her 12-year-old grandson Wesley stood by her side.
I just know he was a good governor.
Your grandma has told you that?
Mm-hmm.
What else has she told you about him?
That he was a Christian man.
McNeely says Askew was a formal governor, and he could get stern when she made mistakes.
When I was doing his scheduling, I sent him to the wrong place. He was not happy. He was doing a public service spot, and that just doesn't go over very well.
She says she fondly remembers accompanying him to the 1974 convention of the Southern Governors Conference, which he chaired.
The biggest difference in his administration was he carried off the office with dignity. He did not let people sway him from his belief.
She says people pressured him to drink alcohol. He never did. And they pushed back hard against his corporate tax, but he didn't back down. Askew was among the progressive Southern Democrats who pushed desegregation. Since his death last week, politicians from both sides of the aisle have sung his praise. But not everyone at the Capitol Tuesday knew the governor.
I don't even know who he is.
LaTanya Davis was sitting on the steps in her pajamas, waiting for a museum guide to let her in so she could do a history class assignment.
I didn't really know all this was going on, but she told me if I wait, she'd give me the brochure I need for class. It's due today.
Inside the historic Capitol Museum lobby, staff director Michelle Gammon Purvis said she'd just seen 85-year-old Askew at the museum when he recently celebrated his retirement from teaching at Florida State University.
Each time I've heard him speak, I get chills, honestly. Yes, he is just somebody who you can tell served for the right reasons and is somebody that is a model for all future elected officials.
At Wednesday's packed church service, Askew's son Kevin recalled him as a kind and gentle father to him and his sister Angela.
He did not want to give one of us any more than the other, so he made sure that we were equal in what we got, which is basically the same as the public. He tried to be fair to everybody, not just a select few.
Former Congressman Jim Baucus said Askew was like a father to him when he worked as the governor's speechwriter. Baucus said Askew's ideals and political courage might seem impossible amidst today's partisanship, but he says the governor's legacy should be an inspiration to all Floridians.
You won't always win, but you'll win in the end. If you're true to yourself and true to the things you believe in. He never did underestimate us, and I would hope we wouldn't underestimate ourselves now in honoring him.
Askew will be honored Thursday at another memorial service in Pensacola before being laid to rest on Friday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Florida lawmakers have rolled out their education spending proposals for the upcoming fiscal year. According to the raw numbers, there's more money for the state's public schools than last year. But as Lynn Hatter reports, while the legislature is looking to up the ante, much of the increase may be coming from the state's property owners.
Education is a hot-button issue in Florida, one that Governor Rick Scott knows well. After slashing billions from public schools after he was initially elected, Scott quickly reversed course and pushed to put the money back after a strong public backlash. His budget proposals this year call for increased dollars for public schools, colleges, and universities, and lawmakers are prepared to deliver on it.
I would, without going through it box by box, draw your attention to the funding increases. As you can see, in public schools, FEFP, we have an increase of $651 million, $18,212.
Senate Education Appropriations Subcommittee Chairman Bill Galvano unveiled his chamber's education spending plan Wednesday. The FEFP is the formula the state uses to break down how much money school districts get per student, and it's coming in at nearly $19 billion in overall K-12 education funding for the upcoming fiscal year. The state and school districts will split that cost, with districts getting their portion from local property taxes. Florida lawmakers aren't looking at increasing property tax rates to account for the increase in spending. Instead, explains Florida's chief economist Amy Baker, they're looking at a rise in property value.
What they're saying is that if you take the same rate and charge it against a higher value, then you're going to bring in more money.
Baker heads the State Office of Economic and Demographic Research and says the numbers lawmakers are using to determine how much local governments will contribute are based on the state's housing market recovery. As property values go up, so does the revenue that fills coffers for school districts.
So it's just like the sales tax. If someone spends a dollar, the state brings in 6 cents on each dollar. But if that same person instead spent $2, we would bring in 12 cents, even though the tax rate didn't change. It was 6% either way.
Baker cautions the numbers lawmakers are working with are estimates and notes final tallies won't be in until June, well after lawmakers have solidified the state's budget. But the House and Senate are recommending similar amounts for per student spending, making good on the governor's call for more dollars going directly into the classroom, says House Education Appropriations Chairman Eric Frezen.
And the education state funding exceeds any previous year in Florida's history.
The House is looking at a nearly $208 per student increase in spending. But this is just the start of the state budget process. The two chambers still have to pass their budgets, and differences in funding amounts have to be ironed out, as Democratic State Representative Dwayne Taylor points out.
This is not the final budget, and that there's a lot of non-recurring dollars that's not in here that we had last year that may possibly be placed in the budget, maybe at the next stop.
One area the two chambers will have to reconcile deals with how much money to put into school district technology and infrastructure. The state is trying to shore up its hardware and classrooms with purchases for tablet computers. It's also trying to get enough bandwidth into schools to run all its new technology. When it comes to such upgrades, the House and Senate are about $40 million apart. Schools will need to boost their digital footprints in time for students to take new exams, which will soon be administered online. For Florida Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, lawmakers are considering a bill that would require hepatitis C testing for the highest risk group. Some worry about taking away doctors' autonomy, while others say it's worth it.
This is just something that would save lives, cut costs.
We'll hear the latest about a parasail regulation bill that some hope will cut down on the tragic deaths and serious injuries associated with the industry.
We just ask that you support this 100% so we can protect not only our residents of Pompano Beach, but the state of Florida.
Lawmakers aren't the only ones who battle it out over issues at the Florida Capitol. Lobbyists and think tanks sometimes get into fights as well. And the state of Florida pays an historic tribute to those who ply the state's waters with rod and reel.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment.
In an effort to get patients treated more quickly, Florida lawmakers are looking at a bill to require the state's doctors to offer hepatitis C testing to baby boomers who are typically more at risk for the disease. But Regan McCarthy reports some are worried the bill's language is too strong.
According to a recent Centers for Disease Control and Prevention study, most of the people in the United States who have hepatitis C are baby boomers. In fact, the study says a person born between 1945 and 1965 is 5 times more likely to have the disease than those of other generations. And Tampa Democratic Senator Arthenia Joyner says many people who are infected don't know it.
A lot of symptoms are not demonstrated until you're at the last quarter and the clock is about ticked out.
Joyner is sponsoring a measure requiring doctors to offer boomers a hepatitis C test. And others, like AIDS Institute Executive Director Michael Ruppel, say getting those who are infected treatment is more important now than ever.
New treatments make it highly likely that a patient, if they decide to be treated, she or he will be able to start and complete their treatment. Unlike HIV and AIDS, which can still not be cured, these new hepatitis C treatments result in a 90% or better effective cure rate. Before the new treatments, less than half of the patients who started treatment were able to finish.
But the American College of Physicians Florida chairman, Jason Goldman, says Joyner's language is too strong and should back off to give doctors more discretion.
We do not think that the state should mandate all physicians to do this, but rather make it known that the test is available for patients, not necessarily a requirement that every physician must do without allowing the physician to make the appropriate decisions on who should and should not be screened.
Joyner argues the measure should be strongly worded. She says ensuring those most at risk for the disease are given the option to get tested will save lives and likely some money along the way.
The mandate is necessary because if a person comes up with hepatitis C and does not know it, they stand to have great liver damage, and which necessitates a liver transplant, which runs into the thousands of dollars of care.
Joyner says if people aren't tested and treated early, they're likely to end up in the state's emergency rooms later. But Goldman says there's no clear evidence requiring testing will help with any of that. He says costs could increase because patients will be tested even if there's no indication for the test. And he says the test has a 10% false positive rate, which could mean more testing for patients who might have already fought off the virus on their own. And he says in other medical cases, doctors have increased health issues in some patients because of blanket treatment programs.
What seems logical doesn't always pan out when you look at the population and the unintended consequences of overtesting, overutilization, and how to implement that in the practice setting.
And Goldman isn't the only person who has concerns with the mandate. Hollywood Democratic Senator Eleanor Sobel says she wants to ensure doctors maintain autonomy.
I have a lot of problems with the state mandating health issues, especially when it concerns women's issues. And I believe that the doctor should decide what's in the best interest of the patient, not the legislature up here.
The bill passed out of the committee, with lawmakers saying they hoped Joyner would consider a language change that would make it clear doctors can have the option to offer the test when symptoms show it's warranted. Joyner said she'd look at the issue, but made no promises. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
After several years of never being taken up in the Florida legislature, a bill seeking to regulate the state's parasailing industry is now heading to the Senate floor. As Sasha Cordner reports, it's a popular water sport in the Sunshine State that's ended in tragedy for some.
It was in 2007 when Crystal White and her little sister Amber went parasailing in Pompano Beach.
I remember right before my sister and I went up, the owner of the company that put us in the air was talking about the weather and that they might have a storm coming through. But he said we should be fine and he put us up anyways.
She says when she and her sister went up, she recalls having fun at first.
I remember being in the air and it was, you know, at first it was amazing and me and my sister were happy. And then all of a sudden, the wind started blowing really hard and it started kind of throwing our parasail all over the place.
And Crystal says she and her sister were terrified.
Suddenly, we noticed we were over the beach and that, you know, it felt like we were being pulled and the wind was blowing so hard against us and our parasail, you know, that we could barely even breathe. And I just remember screaming and yelling down for the operator of the boat to help me and my sister. And then all of a sudden, I heard a loud pop and my mind went blank. That's all I remember of my accident.
What happened next was due to windy conditions, the line connected to the parasail broke and they collided into the roof of a hotel. Crystal still suffers from permanent brain damage, but her 15-year-old sister died that day. That's why Crystal says she's in favor of a bill to regulate the parasail industry. The White Mescal Act is partly named after her sister. It's also named after 28-year-old Kathleen Mescal, a tourist from Connecticut. She died in 2012 in a Pompano Beach parasailing accident. Her harness malfunctioned, causing her to drop 200 feet into the water where she drowned. Their stories touch the heart of Pompano Beach Mayor Lamar Fisher, who's been trying for years to get legislation passed to regulate that water sport to no avail. And after the White Mescal Act unanimously passed its last committee stop Wednesday, Fisher says he couldn't be happier.
It's going to make the difference to where folks will be comfortable in parasailing itself. And so it'll make them have an opportunity to, those families, to understand that their children can go up and hopefully be safe at the end of the day, because the two deaths that happened were in Mar City. And it was just devastating to us.
The person leading that legislative charge in the Senate is Delray Beach Democratic Senator Maria Sachs. She says the bill puts in what she calls common sense regulations into the sport of commercial parasailing, which is one of the few water sports that has no official guidelines on the books.
So what we did is we went to the commercial operators themselves. We said, what is it that puts such risk into this sport? And they all said, weather. So what this bill does is it stops parasailing whenever there's sustained winds of over 20 miles per hour, or if there's a known lightning storm within 7 miles of that operation, they must cease. And they must have a minimum of insurance of $1 million, which is minimum to do business here in the state of Florida.
And now that it's headed to the floor, how sure is she it could go all the way?
I am confident, optimistic, that we will get this through this year.
Some at the Capitol believe the bill has a much greater chance of getting through this year because of a parasailing accident that gained national attention and happened in Senate President Don Gates' district. In that incident, two Indiana teens suffered serious injuries when they went parasailing in Panama City Beach. Authorities say it was due to strong windy conditions. And one of the girls, Alexis Fairchild, visited the Capitol last month to say she supports the bill. Meanwhile, its House companion is close to a 4-vote. It has one more committee stop to go. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Advocacy groups, lobbyists, and public policy think tanks are just as prone as lawmakers to duke it out when they have different takes on issues. Ryan Bank reports on a battle that erupted this week between the Florida Medical Association and Florida Tax Watch.
In what's become an almost annual argument at the Florida legislature, doctors' groups and advanced registered nurses sparred over how to solve the state and country's looming doctor shortage. According to the Annals of Family Medicine, after incorporating insurance expansion, an aging doctor population, and general population growth, the U.S. will need an additional 52,000 primary care physicians by 2025. Florida nurses say an easy way to solve the problem is to allow them to practice independently of a doctor. While doctors say making the profession more financially viable for indebted students makes more sense. Jeff Scott, general counsel for the Florida Medical Association, a powerful physicians lobbying group, says that approach is a no-brainer.
Something that would allow physicians to serve in underserved areas to practice there in exchange for having part of their medical loans repaid on their behalf. And, you know, coming out of medical school, they can easily amass upwards of $200,000 in debt.
Still, registered nurses say loan forgiveness programs can't fully bridge the gap between primary care providers and those in need of care. A recent TaxWatch report seemed to back up those claims. It cites an Office of Program Policy Analysis and Government Accountability, or a PAGA study, in which the state could save up to $339 million by expanding a nurse's scope of practice. Tamara Demko is the director of TaxWatch's Center for Health and Aging. She says highly trained nurses could handle the bulk of Florida's primary care needs.
APRNs, this is a national number that's been thrown around, that they could provide up to 80% of primary care needs for patients.
The Florida Medical Association is calling those numbers dubious and misleading. In a strongly worded press release, Jeff Scott demanded the Policy Watchdog Group rescind its briefing, calling into question the legitimacy of its claims. The research targeted what the FMA calls five serious flaws in TaxWatch's report. It accused TaxWatch of selectively reporting the upper limit of possible savings, not taking into account a patient's preference for doctors over nurses, assuming that advanced registered nurses and physician assistants will continue to cost less than physicians in perpetuity, and FMA's Jeff Scott says there are many more.
Obviously, one of them was the assumption that 100% of the ARMPs would go into independent practice, which is absolutely absurd. That's not happened any place else in which the ARMPs have been allowed to go into independent practice. And there's absolutely no basis, no rational justification to make that assumption.
TaxWatch says those assumptions are plainly stated caveats on the briefing's first page. The watchdog is also calling the FMA a special interest group whose sole intent is to protect the physician's turf. Robert Weissert is TaxWatch's general counsel and chief research officer. He says the report is sound and cited properly.
This is something that TaxWatch, over our nearly 35 years of experience as an independent third-party research entity and public policy watchdog, has seen a number of times. And so I certainly don't mean to say that the FMA is unique or that they're the only group ever to represent a single position and in doing so attack independent research that's based in facts and evidence.
Weissert says TaxWatch has no intention of rescinding its report and that it will continue reporting on the issue. Meanwhile, a bill that would expand a nurse's scope of practice filed by Sebring Republican Representative Kerry Pigman, a doctor himself, has stalled in committee. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Bank.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Now here's Ronald J. Eben and a few of the key meetings on the schedule at the Florida Capitol tomorrow.
The Senate Regulated Industries Committee meets from 8:30 till 10 Thursday morning. Among the bills on the agenda is a measure dealing with increasing the number of registered pharmacy technicians which a licensed pharmacist may supervise. The House Health and Human Services Committee meets from 9 to 11. Included on the agenda is a bill that requires a child's parents or guardian, in addition to the child, to make restitution for damage or loss caused by a child's offense. The Senate goes into session at 1:30 Thursday afternoon. There's Senator Jack Latvala's ethics bill up for debate. There's a bill setting up a high-tech agency. The Aaron Cohen Life Protection Act is on the agenda. That requires the driver of a vehicle involved in a crash that results in serious bodily injury to immediately stop the vehicle and remain at the scene of the crash or face 3 years license revocation. There's Florida's Civil Rights Act prohibiting discrimination on the basis of pregnancy in public lodging and food service establishments and in employment. There's also the Keeping ID Safe or Kids Act, authorizing a representative of a protected consumer to place a security freeze on a protected consumer's report or record, thus prohibiting a consumer reporting agency from stating or implying that a security freeze reflects a negative credit history or rating. Those are some of the highlights during tomorrow's legislative session. I'm Ronald J. Eben.
The term fish story usually denotes a tale that isn't to be taken seriously, but here's a Florida fish story that's about as serious as it gets, mainly because fishing is a very serious activity in Florida.
It's really been an important part of Florida's tourism economy all throughout the 20th century. And long before people were coming here for theme parks, they were coming here to fish. And so it's an important part of tourism economy and Florida's tourism history.
That's Lisa Dunbar with the Florida Department of State. She's curator of a new exhibit called The Lure of Florida Fishing that's now in the Museum of Florida History, just a block from the state capitol.
There are a variety of artifacts that date from like the early 1900s with the beginning of sport fishing and going up to the present. There are tarpon scales, there is tackle, fishing reels, fishing rods, we have fish mounts, we have artwork from William Aiken Walker, who was a well-known Southern artist in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
In an average year, there are more than 25 million fishing trips taken in Florida's fresh and marine waters. All those trips generate more than $7 billion in economic activity and support somewhere around 70,000 jobs. Dunlap says the perpetual popularity of fishing isn't hard to figure out because it's something that anybody and everybody can do, regardless of life circumstances.
There are people who just go out and, you know, sit by the river and fish, or people who go out on charter boats. It's a wide variety.
The fishing exhibit doesn't only feature tackles, trophies, and a huge assortment of mounted fish.
I do have a section on conservation and the efforts being taken to protect the fisheries today.
In fact, Dunbar says the exhibit itself shows examples of how, not all that long ago, conservation awareness among anglers was often in short supply, particularly when it came to big game fish.
The tarpon is a game fish, and people really didn't consume it. And so they would catch the fish and then take a picture with it and just note the weight of the fish and then pretty much discard it.
Today, there are also many state rules when it comes to fishing, which regulate what kinds of fish can be caught when. All this, however, has not dampened the enthusiasm of the millions who take to Florida's fresh and salt waters in pursuit of fish. The colorful tribute to their sport, The Lure of Florida Fishing, will remain at the Museum of Florida History in Tallahassee through August 26th. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Eben, Lynn Hatter, Stan Jastrzemski, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo, along with Ryan Bank. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us again each weeknight during the 2014 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Tallahassee Regional Airport, offering service through American Airlines with daily direct flights from Tallahassee to Miami and Dallas-Fort Worth, with connections to over 270 domestic and international destinations. Fares and information available online at aa.com. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.